Oracy is broader than this, so it's not just about the mechanics of language itself, but how we use language to organize our thoughts and talk about our ideas and build relationships. A phrase that you might hear quite a lot in relation to oracy is that it's both about learning to talk and learning through talk. If we think about the kind of language we use when we talk about thoughts and feelings, we have words like think, feel, know, believe. So being able to understand and use these words helps children not only to make sense of their own experiences, you know, tell their own stories and regulate their emotions, but it also helps them to understand that others have their own thoughts and feelings. These language experiences don't just shape children's kind of day-to-day interactions, they're also linked to long-term outcomes. Having these skills in the early years is really important to sort of set children on a positive path for the rest of their lives. If we put it in the broader picture, I guess oracy skills are essential for children to grow into kind of active and informed members of society.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Norfolk Early Years podcast, Let's Talk series, a show that helps early years practitioners and professionals understand more about effectively supporting children's speech, language and communication development in the early years. I'm Jo Patterson.
And I'm Ashley Cater.
And we are Early Years Communication and Language Development Officers within Norfolk County Council's Early Years team. And today, we're privileged to be joined by the very knowledgeable Dr. Nicola Dawson, researcher at Oxford University, speech and language therapist at Morehouse School and College, and advocate for all things language literacy and oracy. In today's episode, we're going to be exploring what we mean by the term oracy and how we can build this into our early years practice. So without further ado, let's talk building oracy in the early years. So, welcome, Nikki. Could you start by telling us a little bit about who you are, where you're based, and how you ended up in your current role?
Yes, thank you for the introduction. So, I'm Nikki Dawson. I'm a researcher and speech and language therapist. So, I currently split my time across two settings. So, 4 days a week, I'm based at the University of Oxford, where I work as a research fellow. And then 1 day a week, I'm based at Morehouse School and College in Surrey. So this is a specialist educational provision for children and adolescents with developmental language disorder, which I might go into a little bit more later. And these children are aged between 7 and 19 years old. And so I'm based in the Research and Training Institute that's attached to the school. And my role there is mainly to conduct research into language interventions for DLD and also to share our findings with others in speech and language therapy practice and education. So in terms of how I ended up here, I actually started with a degree in English literature. So reading and books were always something I loved, and I was very happy to spend 3 years reading and thinking about words and language. And then I became interested in language development during a couple of years as an au pair in Paris. So I lived with a multilingual family, and I saw firsthand what language development across three different languages simultaneously looked like. And so following that, I decided to train as a speech and language therapist. So this was around 15 years ago. And I was then based for around 3 years in mainstream school services. And then I moved into academia as a research assistant, where I worked on a project looking at reading and vocabulary skills in early adolescence. And from there, I did my PhD, which was focused more on reading skills again in adolescent learners. And then finally, after completing my PhD, I had a really wonderful opportunity to start a role at Oxford as a researcher. So this was on a project funded by the Nuffield Foundation, where we were looking at the language of children's books, particularly picture books aimed at children in the early years, and thinking about how hearing the language of these books regularly supports children's language development and oracy.
Super, thank you. Very interesting backstory. So as we know, we're going to be talking a little bit about oracy today, which I know you're really passionate about. And I'm mindful that in the 2024 oracy report, We Need to Talk, it says, to date, there has been no universally agreed upon definition of oracy, nor a broad consensus on its role in education. So for the purposes of this podcast and the conversation that we're about to have, I was wondering if you could start by sharing your definition of oracy and what this looks like in education.
Okay, yeah, sure. So I think very broadly, oracy refers to how we express ourselves, how we develop understanding, and how we listen to and respond to others effectively through speaking, listening, and communication. So some examples of oracy in everyday life might include things like presenting in class, or collaborating in group work, reciting a poem, or being interviewed for a job. So essentially what we're talking about firstly is children's ability to express what they mean confidently. So this doesn't necessarily mean just sounding polished, but it's about having the skills to communicate their thoughts and intentions. And secondly, another aspect of oracy is using speaking and listening as tools for thinking and learning. So this is how we develop understanding through oracy. And then the third key part is to be able to communicate effectively with others in different situations. So I think an important thing to note is that this definition talks about speaking, listening, and communication. So this can also include nonverbal forms of communication, such as sign language or use of communication aids, for example. And so I think this raises quite an important distinction between oracy and oral language skills. So I see oral language skills as a kind of critical component of oracy, but it's not the complete picture. So when we talk about oral language, we're kind of talking about the mechanics of language used in spoken communication. So, for example, speech sounds, vocabulary, grammar, and so on. But oracy is broader than this. So it's not just about the mechanics of language itself, but how we use language to organize our thoughts and talk about our ideas and build relationships. So a phrase that you might hear quite a lot in relation to oracy is that it's both about learning to talk and learning through talk. So I think that's quite an important kind of pairing to bear in mind. And then in terms of how it's been introduced in education, so Voice 21, who are one of the kind of main charities involved in promoting oracy, have kind of put forward the oracy framework, which is a way that they suggest provides a kind of structured way to teach and evaluate oracy skills. So their kind of way of thinking about oracy is that it's equivalent to things like literacy and numeracy, and it should be kind of taught systematically in the same way. And so there are four strands of the oracy framework. So first of all, physical. So this relates to things like speech sound development, how we pace our speech and things like body language and so on. Then there's the linguistic strand, which might be kind of more what we think about when we think about oral language skills. So vocabulary, grammar, syntax, things like metaphor, maybe register, those kinds of things. Then there's the cognitive strand. So this is kind of how we choose particular content to convey a meaning. So might be things like structuring our arguments, explaining our reasoning, thinking aloud, and self-regulation, things like that. And then finally, there's the social and emotional strand. So this is about the building relationships, working with others, kind of confidence in speaking, turn-taking, and so on. So each of these kind of strands feeds into what we are talking about when we talk about oracy, and also provides a little bit of structure for earlier settings and schools to think about how they can kind of embed oracy within the curriculum.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks, Nikki. So now we kind of know what oracy is. Can you explain a little bit about the role that oracy plays in our day-to-day life? So I'm thinking more along from a perspective of building a well-functioning society, but also that personal standpoint as well. And why is having good oracy skills important on both of these levels?
Okay, yeah, that's a really big question, actually. So so let's break it down a little bit. And I'll start by talking about personal development. So we can think about this both in terms of children's learning and also their social and emotional development. So if we talk first about learning, so we know from research that having strong spoken language skills in the early years really sets the stage for later success in reading and writing. There's a very kind of direct link between oral language and learning to read and write. So for example, when we look at longitudinal studies that follow the same children over a period of time, we find that children who have very limited language skills at age five are then around four times more likely to have poor adult literacy at age 34 compared to those whose language skills are kind of as expected on school entry. And then, of course, as children get older and they move through primary and secondary school, these literacy skills become ever more important. And this is kind of a shift in education from learning to read to reading to learn. So if you haven't got those fundamental skills, then children are going to struggle across the board. So those kind of reading and writing skills are absolutely essential, not just in subjects like English, but also maths, science, and basically everything else. So by prioritising oracy in the early years, we're setting a really strong foundation for these later skills to develop. And then if we think about children's kind of social and emotional development, I've already kind of touched on how oracy skills are central to how children build relationships. So we can think about, you know, we draw on language very heavily when we're resolving conflicts or we're asking for help. So children really need all of these skills in order to build those social relationships. And of course, that has a knock-on effect for emotional well-being and a kind of feeling of social belonging. So, for example, if we think about the kind of language we use when we talk about thoughts and feelings, we have words like think, feel, know, believe. So being able to understand and use these words helps children not only to make sense of their own experiences, tell their own stories and regulate their emotions, but it also helps them to understand that others have their own thoughts and feelings. And so this is at the heart of theory of mind, so the ability to understand that other people have thoughts, beliefs, and emotions that might be different from your own. And we can see, you know, how this language can work in practice through, for example, listening to stories or engaging in pretend play. So in stories, children encounter characters with different perspectives, different kind of motivations, who experience different emotions. And so language can kind of give children to the tools to reflect on these mental states and also hopefully then to be able to navigate their own social worlds with the kind of empathy and understanding of others. So again, these language experiences don't just shape children's kind of day-to-day interactions, they're also linked to long-term outcomes too. So for example, when we look at other longitudinal research, we find that children with language that's below the expected level at school entry, so around 5 years old, they have a much higher risk of mental health problems about around 30 years later, so almost three times higher, even after we take into account things like family background and early health that might also explain that relationship. And they're also twice as likely to experience long periods of unemployment. So yeah, having these skills in the early years is really important to sort of set children on a positive path for the rest of their lives. But of course, there's a word of caution here, because we can't say that early language problems directly cause these outcomes. There are always many complex interacting factors, but these associations do reinforce, I think, just how important it is to support children's communication from the start, not just for school readiness, but also for their long-term well-being and life chances. And then I think the other thing you mentioned was about kind of society, which is, again, is a big question. So, you know, if we put it in the broader picture, I guess oracy skills are essential for children to grow into kind of active and informed members of society. So we live in a very, what you could describe as an information-based society. So information and knowledge are kind of at the heart of everything about kind of our economic lives, our social and cultural lives as well. So we're constantly sharing, receiving information via texts, social media and emails and so on. And we're surrounded by kind of 24-hour news, people's opinions and blogs and so on. And also when you talk to the summary research showing that employers are really kind of prioritizing kind of oracy and collaboration within the workplace. So all of this means that being able to kind of critically evaluate what you hear and understand people's different viewpoints is really important just for participating in society. And it also, of course, gives people a voice to speak up for things that are important to them. So taking part in kind of campaigns for change or writing to an MP, all of that draws on your ability to frame language in a way that's persuasive and argumentative. So I guess by supporting these skills early on, we're providing children then with the tools they need to navigate society in the kind of modern world.
So there seems to be a bit of a growing spotlight on oracy at the moment, Nikki. I personally feel that I've heard more about oracy in the last 2 or 3 years in my career than I have, you know, for the previous 10 potentially. It seems to be a bit of a buzzword at the moment, not necessarily just in early years, but I think across the board in education. And I know you mentioned earlier about Voice 21 and the role that charity is playing in spreading awareness of oracy. But what I wanted to know is who else is talking about oracy and what is being said and why is that so important at the moment?
Voice 21, obviously one of the kind of leading organisations in promoting oracy. So they're an education charity founded around 10 years ago, I think, as part of a collaboration between Cambridge University and a school in East London, which I think that work was funded by the Education Endowment Foundation. And so, yeah, their kind of purpose and aim is to support schools in embedding oracy into their curriculums. But they also campaign for oracy to have greater recognition more broadly within the education system. And so as part of this, they set up the Oracy Education Commission, which produced a report last year called We Need to Talk. I know you're familiar with that. So one of the things that the report argues for is this more kind of explicit recognition and teaching of oracy, and for it to be given this kind of equal status with things like literacy and numeracy. But I think, as you say, it's become a bit of a buzzword, really. And I think more broadly, there's a growing interest from across education and even extending, as I say, to employers and policymakers. So, for example, Keir Starmer made a commitment to making oracy a priority at all stages of education. And I think it's going to feature in the upcoming curriculum and assessment review. It should be published this year. So in terms of timing, I think the COVID-19 pandemic and kind of lockdowns had a lot to do with it, played a big part. So this meant that obviously children missed out on education and potentially also missed out on kind of rich face-to-face interactions during that very critical period of early development, you know, particularly for children who were in the early years at the time. And so this had the effect of kind of widening existing social inequalities. So for example, if you take away these universal educational experiences, then children's learning is much more dependent on the resources and language-rich interactions that are available at home. And of course, this can vary greatly between families for whatever reason. And another reason why we might see kind of growing interest in oracy now is that we live, as I say, in a society that's seen very rapid technological changes in recent years. So with the increasing use of AI, it feels like humans, you know, very human-specific skills like communication, empathy, persuasion, critical discussion, these kinds of things that AI can't so easily replicate might become more and more valuable to employers. But I think there's also here maybe a note of caution around what oracy can and can't do. So, for example, oracy has sometimes been framed as a path to greater social equality. And while it does clearly underpin so much of learning and personal and social development that might open up opportunities for children that they may not otherwise have, some people have argued that this framing can sometimes overlook sort of deeper structural issues relating to inequality, such as how certain ways of speaking are privileged over others. So I think, you know, yes, there's a lot of excitement about the idea of oracy and a lot of drive to really embed this across education. But at the same time, there are other voices just kind of sounding a note of caution about sort of what we, you know, it being a kind of fix-all for everything, I suppose. Yeah.
Excellent. So we're now going to shift that focus to practice and pedagogy. And I think it's really important to recognise that, like most things in the early years, oracy education isn't about buying into a rigid intervention programme that pulls children out of their learning environment and away from their peers. But instead, it's about us finding ways to weave in effective practices into our continuous provision and offer children lots of opportunities for talk and child-led play in ways that work for that setting. So with that in mind, we thought it would be really helpful to explore some of the ideas and strategies that practitioners can use to enhance their practice. We're going to look at the environment. And so can you think about how practitioners can create a learning environment that effectively supports and nurtures children's oracy development?
So the learning environment really needs to offer a kind of wide range of opportunities for language-rich activity across the day. So ideally, this would include spaces for activities such as role play, storytelling, small group interactions. So kind of activities where children can practice using their language in kind of new and imaginative ways. And we can think quite carefully about how to design these spaces in ways that are likely to promote engagement and learning. So for example, you could rotate setups for play settings. So for example, rotating between a shop, a home, a hospital, because this would give children opportunities to use and hear a broader range of vocabulary. So the words and phrases that we typically use in shops are quite different from what we might use in hospitals. So providing this kind of wide range of possible play scenarios can then give children opportunities to experiment with more diverse language And also potentially language that they might not come across in their kind of day-to-day lives. We can also think about the props that we are kind of including in the setting. So using real-world props like telephones or shopping baskets, puppets and costumes and so on, can encourage children to sort of take on different roles and to build narratives. And then this kind of imaginative play can often lead to extended talk, because children are kind of negotiating these roles and trying to solve problems between themselves. Another area that I'm very passionate about is the availability of books and stories. So these could include kind of traditional stories from different cultures and also maybe bilingual books if you have a high proportion of children speaking English as an additional language. Nice of these books can cover a variety of genres, so fiction, but also potentially non-fiction if that's more engaging for certain children. And maybe books that reflect children's own experiences. So there are lots of books out there that's sort of written with kind of experiences such as loss or bereavement in mind. And so children who might be going through this can then find a book that sort of speaks to them in that situation. And finally, if I know for that reason, earlier settings are very noisy usually, and it's usually space is an issue. But if you can kind of create a space that's a little bit more quiet, a little bit less distracting, those can be quite nice for children who maybe find it a little bit overwhelming, or maybe if you want to work one-to-one or have more group conversations. And so this space can be a bit more kind of calm and promote more focused engagement. And for some children, that might kind of boost their confidence in kind of talking up and using their voice.
So, Nikki, you touched on the importance of books just then when you were talking about providing rich play experiences. Why is storytelling so important to building children's oracy?
So books and storytelling can really be an excellent way to provide these kind of rich language experiences. Obviously, it provides children with the opportunity to kind of listen to and structure their own narratives. But also, we've done some work showing that even though children can't yet read independently necessarily in the early years, the language of children's books is much more complex and richer than language that they get from everyday conversation. So actually, by reading books with children or even telling stories that uses this kind of book language, I'm talking about book language as being a sort of different type of language that we use in those kinds of contexts, but not necessarily just the words on the page. So it kind of gives children a way into books when they can't actually access them themselves because they're not yet reading. So what we found in our own research was that when we look at children's picture books, so these are books aimed at really young children, they already contain a wider range of words, going back to the idea that children can experience language that's related to scenarios that they might not experience firsthand in everyday life. So if we think about when we're talking to children during daily routines, often because it's the same routine every day, we're using the same language. But if you're reading children picture books that relate to lots of different scenarios, fantasy and so on, then the kind of language that's going to be in those books is going to be much more diverse than what they would get from conversation. And we also found that the words in books tend to be much more sophisticated. So they're the kind of words that children would tend to acquire later on in development. So by giving children exposure to these words early on in their development, we're kind of laying the foundations for that later, more literate language knowledge. Another thing we found that was that these picture books contain more emotion words. And so this is really important when we're thinking about the development of children's emotion vocabulary and their ability to talk about their feelings. And as I mentioned earlier, to understand the thoughts and feelings of others. And as I say, it's not just about the content of the books. They also can provide an excellent springboard for kind of role play and practicing narrative skills. So you can link books to play in order to extend those language opportunities. So for example, after reading a story about going to the doctor, you might set up a role play area that has sort of medical props. And then that provides opportunities for children to try out this new vocabulary that they'd encountered in the story in a kind of meaningful and imaginative way.
Yeah, I think it really highlights how important it is to have books freely available all day during your setting, not just at story time necessarily, but just available within the provision for children to access as and when they want to.
Yeah.
Thank you. That was really interesting. I was also just going to do a little plug here for the Norfolk Library Service as well. We're really privileged to have a fantastic library service here in Norfolk. And I'm sure we're going to talk a little bit about parents and carers later in the role that they play in building children's oracy. But even for our settings, I know that the Norfolk Library Service is always very willing to work with settings to find books that they may want to introduce into their settings. So that's just a reminder, I guess, for our practitioners to make use of that service because it's extremely valuable. Thank you, Nikki, for sharing that information on practice and pedagogy. We're now going to move on to talk a little bit about the role of the adult and interactions. I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of an early years practitioner who's standing in their setting or in their reception classroom. And as you touched on earlier, it can be quite a busy place, sometimes quite a noisy place as well. And I'm sure there'll be lots of play and interactions that are just happening naturally around them. So my question is, what can practitioners do to turn those everyday moments and interactions into opportunities for really meaningful talk that's going to enhance their oracy skills?
Yeah, I think this is really key. So as we've kind of touched on, I think oracy development doesn't require a special session. It's something that can happen throughout the day, kind of in the flow of everyday interactions. You know, but particularly when the adults are kind of consciously thinking about how they can promote these kind of rich language skills for children. So a few things that practitioners could sort of think about, kind of very specific things, is firstly, think about how you're asking questions. So really, we want to be trying to ask open-ended questions that gives children the kind of opportunity to expand on their responses. So using questions like how, why, what do you think, why do you think. This is going to help to kind of extend children's thinking and also invite them to use richer language in their responses. So, for example, if you say, why do you think the caterpillar ate so much? This is going to encourage kind of reasoning and explanation rather than just a yes or no answer, which is what we get maybe if we ask slightly more closed questions. Another thing we can do is try to encourage multi-turn conversations. So by that, I mean exchanges between the adult and the child that goes beyond just one question and answer. So to do this, we can just allow some time. So we're in conversation with a child, but we pause and we wait for their response. And just by pausing, we can indicate that we are kind of anticipating that the child might say something back. So this is going to support kind of contingent language use, so where the adult's responding to the child's focus and also potentially joint attention as well. And it also, of course, shows a genuine interest in what children are saying. Another key thing is obviously children in early year settings are, you know, the language skills are very much still developing. So children are going to be using slightly simpler sentence structures than they would if they were older. But we can actually take what they've said and build on it. So we're modelling a slightly more complex version of what they've initially said. So, for example, if a child says he's mad, we could say something like, yes, he looks frustrated because he lost his toy. So you can see how we're not sort of asking them to produce that more complex sentence and we're not sort of telling them they're wrong in any way, but we're just agreeing with them, but also adding something and modelling that more complex sentence structure with kind of reasoning embedded in there. Another thing we can do is just comment on what children are doing. So if we're kind of narrating what they're doing currently in that moment, especially during routines or play, then this is going to sort of help them to sort of provide them with a language model that they might then be able to use themselves at a later point. And I think what's quite important to say is that we're modelling this language without actually correcting them. So we're not putting children on the spot or correcting any grammatical errors directly, but instead we're just modelling the kind of more advanced form of language naturally within the conversation. And then finally, going back to what I was saying about shared book reading. So I was talking about sort of the language of the books themselves. But of course, book reading is also an opportunity to use kind of dialogic book talk. So we could ask both literal questions, but also inferential questions, ask children to make predictions about what they think is going to happen next. We can read a page, leave a pause and see if children can come up with what they think the next word might be. And just allow space for children to express what they think. So things like, you know, why do you think the rabbit is hiding? This is going to allow them the opportunity to promote reasoning and possibly empathy as well.
Super, thank you. You mentioned it a little bit there in your answer, but for children that feel self-conscious with their speech, it might be that they have a speech and language need or perhaps they're just a little bit less confident than their peers. How do we go about building that oracy when they may feel quite self-conscious?
Yeah, so many of the strategies, as you say, I just mentioned, will help to make sure that our kind of interactions with children are sensitive and responsive. So if we follow the child's lead and we build on the contributions that they've made, then we're less likely to make them feel judged or exposed compared to if we sort of put them on the spot or correct their errors. So I think the key thing here is to focus on what they're saying, not how they're saying it. So if a child is shy about speaking, for example, we can still model rich language. So, for example, if we're talking, you know, about something with the child in the immediate environment, we can model sort of thinking language or metacognitive language, such as I wonder if or I think. So what we're doing there is modeling the process of thinking, showing children how to think and reason and reflect, but we're not directly putting them on the spot. And of course, this more generally will promote a kind of a culture where this sort of wondering and questioning and not knowing are just part of learning. And that's what we want children to understand, because we want them to embrace that kind of language in their own kind of oracy skills. And as I said, we can use comments rather than testing questions. So testing questions are things that we already know the answer to. So if we ask, for example, what color is that or what's this called, children know that we already know the answer to that. So then that makes them feel as though they're being tested. And it might make them feel under pressure. But if we comment, then this puts less pressure on children because they can choose how they want to answer. So if we say, for example, wow, I love this purple car, the child might then take that as an invitation to tell you about their favourite colour or their car or something else completely. And then I guess another way we can reduce pressure on individual children is just to embrace oracy as a whole class or whole setting thing. It's something that everybody does, not something that particular children are singled out for, and there's no kind of right or wrong. And I suppose maybe small group work might be useful here as well, particularly if that group is kind of carefully selected. So children might be more comfortable kind of interacting with some peers than others, and it's also then easier for practitioners to tailor their own language support to a child's developmental level. And then I suppose also thinking about feedback and praise. So we're praising kind of effort and ideas, not kind of the pronunciation or grammar. So it kind of reinforces the message that what matters is communicating, thinking together, not necessarily getting it right.
So we just wanted to touch a little bit on SEND, if that's okay, Nikki. How can oracy teaching in the early years be adapted to effectively support children with SEND and ensure that their ways of communicating are not overlooked?
Yeah, this is a really important question. So I guess the first thing to acknowledge is that oracy shouldn't mean valuing just one type of talk. Hopefully that's come across already. So we need to be a little bit mindful of this value that we're assigning to oracy skills, because I guess there's a potential for bias towards more extrovert or verbal children. So if we focus too narrowly on just confident, fluent speech, we risk overlooking children with SEND who may communicate differently. So when given the kind of central role of oral language skills in oracy, children with language difficulties may be particularly in need of adapted approaches or increased adult support and also more time and more practice. So as I mentioned earlier, I work with children, although mostly older children, with developmental language disorder or DLD. So this is a lifelong condition in which children have difficulty understanding and using their first language. So it's not about learning a second language. And where there's no obvious cause for this. So it's not the kind of outcome of a biomedical condition such as hearing loss or a neurological condition. So DLD affects around 7.5% of the population, or to put it another way, 2 children in every classroom. So it's as common as dyslexia and more common than autistic spectrum disorder, but there's much less public awareness around it. And DLD might be difficult to diagnose in the early years because a lot of children who are late talkers go on to then develop age-appropriate language. But within an oracy context, I guess some early signs might be things like children using fewer words than other children or maybe taking longer to start combining those words into sentences. They might struggle to follow instructions, especially if there are kind of multiple steps to those instructions. They might find it harder to answer these kind of open-ended questions that we've been talking about, or to retell what's happened in a story or what they've done in their day. So there's kind of more unstructured narrative skills. And they might produce sentences that are short or incomplete or ungrammatical in a way that's not kind of typical of their developmental stage. So maybe something like me go park instead of I went to the park. And of course, these children might also appear quiet or frustrated or disengaged, particularly during activities that are language heavy. And so often these kinds of language difficulties might be labelled as behavioural issues. So then if we're thinking about sort of adaptations that we might make to support these children with SEND, including those with DLD, they will often need more time to process information and instructions, and also to formulate their own ideas and plan what they want to say. So I guess one way that we can address this without singling out children is to try and create an environment where thinking time is normalised for everyone. Another adaptation is to use visual supports. So children with DLD and other special educational needs often have difficulties with working memory. And so while language is very transient and it sort of appears the moment we speak, something that's visual is a bit more permanent and it allows the child time to process what they've heard. So this could be things like pictures or symbols or even just gestures. So for example, during tidy up time, practitioners could use a visual schedule, or they might use kind of picture cards showing each area of the room, like a picture of the book corner, the blocks, the water tray, alongside the spoken instructions that they're giving. And so this would help children with language difficulties who might not be able to process multi-step verbal instructions straight away, by giving them a kind of clear visual reminder that they can refer back to while they complete the task. And sort of linked to this, we can think about how we word those instructions and break them down into more manageable chunks. So rather than saying something like, before you go outside, put your painting on the drying rack and wash your hands, that's a very complex instruction because it involves two actions plus a before you go outside. It's a third action that's sort of somewhere happening in the future. It also includes a word that's kind of related to a time concept, which can be very challenging for children with language difficulties, so before. So instead, we could say something like, let's put your painting on the drying rack. Now it's time to wash your hands. Then we can go outside. So you're really breaking that down into single steps, which really helps with that kind of temporal sequencing. And then, of course, that's even better if you have pictures or symbols that you can point to. And then another adaptation is repetition. So this is also really important for children with language difficulties and or DLD. So research shows that children with language difficulties need around three times as many exposures to a word that's embedded in a storybook to learn it compared to children with typical language development.
That's really interesting. I was just going to quickly ask, you mentioned about take-up time and thinking time. How much thinking time is enough thinking time, in your opinion?
That's a really good question. So I guess I don't have a magic number. I guess it's about being sensitive. It will vary depending on, you know, the children that you have in your setting. So their age, you know, their needs, and the individual children that you're working with at that particular point in time. But I think it's about sort of just trying to, I think it matters less about sort of how much time you give and more that it's something that's just normalized, because you don't want it to sort of come across as, for this particular child, you have to wait a long time, but for everybody else, they're just going to reply straight away. So it's about kind of making that a part of how we think and how we respond for everybody. Maybe not so much about how long it needs to be. I think, as I say, that would sort of be, you know, practitioners know the children in their setting better than anyone else. So I think they would probably have a good idea of those children and what they need.
I think the reason I ask is I think sometimes as adults, silence can feel really overwhelming. And actually, we have this real tendency to sometimes jump in and, you know, something that maybe feels like 10 seconds might actually be 3 or 4 seconds, but it just feels a long time because we're not used to having a silence there and waiting for a response.
So
it's a really important reminder to just be mindful of that take-up time and that thinking time, and you know, make sure we are doing that inclusively and doing it across our classroom for every child. So no, really good reminder.
So maybe that's a good place to start, is just to sort of get used to, okay, 5 seconds doesn't sound like a long time, but let's just time it and see how long that feels like, you know, and just get used to that feeling of waiting. Because I agree, I think it's very much kind of an instinct that we want to jump in because we want to help children, you know, and it's that kind of instinct to, you know, either answer for them or, you know, provide a prompt or do something, when actually maybe just what they need is a little bit more time to formulate their thoughts.
So Nikki, we've kind of touched on how would we best support oracy development for those children with English as an additional language.
Okay, so I think the first thing to say is that children who use English as an additional language are language learners, so they're not language delayed, although of course there might be some cases where there is also an underlying language difficulty. And also, although we obviously group them together, as EAL. These children do represent a very diverse group who come from a range of social, economic and geographical backgrounds. So with this in mind, I guess an important thing to think about is valuing and drawing on that child's first language. So children's home languages are a resource rather than a barrier. So encouraging children to use all of their languages helps to kind of build conceptual understanding because they can sort of see how different concepts go across different languages. And also, of course, it helps to support their feelings of identity and confidence. So even if staff in the setting don't speak the same language, just by showing interest or using kind of bilingual books or visuals or encouraging home language use with families can make a big difference. And I guess, you know, similarly, as we've talked about previously, modelling kind of very rich and clear English in meaningful contexts can be helpful for children. So as we've talked about, language learning is most effective when it's embedded in kind of real world experiences. So again, narrating on children's actions, commenting on play, and using repetition and gestures and so on to support understanding. And then I think, you know, the question around creating activities and opportunities to talk without that pressure is important here too. So again, that kind of small group work or short shared storytelling gives children with speaking English as an additional language to opportunities to hear and practice language in kind of more low stakes settings. And finally, I think going back to the idea of giving children time, so they might just need some time to tune into the rhythms and patterns of English. So if they are quiet in activities, we don't want to put pressure on them to speak. We can sort of respect the fact that this might be part of their learning process of kind of acquiring English and still include them in these activities, but just not putting pressure on them to contribute in ways that they're not necessarily comfortable with.
I think it really highlights, doesn't it, just what a diverse range of needs we have in our classrooms nowadays and in our settings. Obviously, we've spoken about SEND and particularly developmental language delay. We've spoken about EAL children and also the whole range of other different speech and language needs that are out there as well that we haven't even touched on. So just to throw another one in the mix, why don't we? I wanted to quickly talk about dialects as well, which perhaps is something that we don't often think about when we're thinking about the kind of languages that present in our classroom. So obviously, when we talk about dialects, we're talking about the way that we kind of use unique words and phrases and how they may have been pronounced slightly differently in different parts of the country. And with people moving around a lot more these days, I think it's not that uncommon that we probably do see a range of dialects within our setting. So I was just having a little think. I don't know. I know that, Nikki, you're based in Oxford and you're probably not a Norfolk girl like me and Joe maybe are at the moment. But obviously in Norfolk, we have a few of our own little phrases and sayings. So I thought I'd give you a little test, see if you know what these mean. Do you know a bishy barney bee?
I don't, so.
So that's a Norfolk saying for a ladybird. And something else that we might often say in Norfolk as well is that we might refer to something being on the h. Have you heard of that one before?
No,
on the h. So if something is on the h in Norfolk, it means it's on the wonk. You might hang a picture frame and it might be on the h, might be on the wonk a little bit. But yeah, just thinking about dialects and all of this being in mind, how do we ensure that we are celebrating language diversity and dialect in our classroom, particularly around our work with oracy? And not just valuing, I think, what people seem to call standard English or the Queen's English as being the kind of only correct form of speaking.
Yeah, I think this is a really important consideration around oracy. So I guess the most important message to get across is that oracy is about adding to a child's communication toolkit, not replacing what they already have. So we're not trying to erase or correct children's home language or dialect or their kind of cultural ways of speaking. But it's true, I think, that the education system and society more widely do privilege certain kinds of speech, usually this more formal standard English. And while, of course, there is growing recognition that we need to value different ways of speaking, I think there's still a long way to go. But I guess in the meantime, by exposing children to kind of different modes of language, we can try and give them the understanding and the skills to code switch or adapt their language for different contexts.
What do we mean by modes of language, sorry?
Yeah, so I mean sort of different registers potentially. So, you know, the language that we use when we are, let's say, I don't know, in a courtroom is going to be very different to the kind of language we use when we're out having a drink with our friends, you know. And same, you know, even for children, you know, they learn that the way they speak maybe to siblings at home is very different to the way they speak to kind of teachers or practitioners in earlier settings. So yeah, so it's just the idea, it's just being aware that language can be used differently and is used differently across different contexts. And so having the knowledge and the flexibility to be able to adapt your communication style to suit these contexts, I think, is a really important skill for children to learn. And that's what I mean too about not replacing. We're not saying that the way they speak is wrong in any way. That's absolutely valid. But you know, the way I speak is different depending on the context that I'm in. So yeah. And I guess, you know, in terms of celebrating language diversity within early years practices, I suppose recognizing that, you know, dialects aren't kind of incorrect versions of English. They have actually their own structures and vocabulary and grammar. And so kind of validating them and legitimizing them as forms of communication can help children feel respected and included. So we can sort of help children to explore how language varies in different contexts. So you could say something like, we use different words at home, at school, or in stories, and then explore some of these examples with children, just to kind of really make explicit this idea that language is something that's very creative and very flexible. And of course, you know, you could use books or songs or storytelling that actually reflects these different dialects of the children in your setting. So maybe you could invite families to share kind of phrases or idioms that they use and kind of build these into activities or displays within the earlier settings.
That's a really nice idea. I think it's nice to kind of help build their identity as well and the way that they feel connected to the area that they're from. So they're really lovely suggestions.
Yeah, and I think just showing curiosity as well. So, you know, if a child is using a particular word or a particular phrase, you know, you can ask them about, or just say, you know, what words do you use at home for this? Or what does your family call this? You know, you can sort of talk about the fact that people use language in different ways.
Lovely. Thank you, Nikki.
Okay, we're going to kind of move on to, you know, what we think may be some challenges and opportunities. So I guess the first thing we just want to ask you, Nikki, is, what barriers do our early years practitioners face in prioritising oracy? You know, and do you feel there are any strategies they can sort of use to overcome these barriers?
Yeah, so I suppose particularly when children get to reception, I suppose one barrier is that there's a lot of pressure to get children kind of school ready. So often that's sort of means focusing on early reading, like foundational reading skills, numeracy. But as we've discussed, you know, oracy is the foundation that supports all of that. So if children can't express themselves or understand spoken instructions, then they're going to struggle when it comes to learning phonics or reading stories or, you know, even joining in with early mark making on paper. So I guess that, you know, overcoming that barrier is just about recognizing that we can do oracy and through everything that we do, not just as a sort of separate thing and separate kind of element to children's learning. And I guess another challenge potentially is practitioner confidence around knowing what good oracy practice looks like. I mean, we've discussed a little bit about the definition of oracy, and I don't think anybody is really in agreement about what it means. So, I don't, you know, how are we expecting early years practitioners to know what it means? So I think, you know, it's sort of trying to embed what we know is good practice in terms of early language skills into our everyday work. And I think that kind of highlights the need as well for targeted professional development and kind of practical strategies, the kinds of things that we've been talking about that can show practitioners how they can embed oracy and also what they're already doing. I think that's another important point. Actually, I think earlier settings are almost at the forefront of oracy because for a long time, oral language skills have been very important across the earliest foundation stage curriculum. And, you know, it's recognised that speaking and listening actually underpin all of the seven areas of learning. So in some ways, I think we can look to earlier settings as being an example of how oracy education is already happening. And then I guess, you know, there's a sort of setting that we've talked about as well, the fact that, you know, earlier settings are very busy and noisy places. So it can be hard to kind of prioritize talk within those settings. But I think, again, these little changes can have a big impact over time. So slowing down to really listen to children, using these open-ended questions or setting up a kind of area that involves sort of quieter time and more opportunities for one-to-one talk.
I think remembering as well as a practitioner, amongst all of the busyness and the things that you're probably thinking that you need to do, it's kind of remembering the key skills, isn't it, that you've mentioned earlier? And I'm just wondering whether perhaps visual aids for the practitioners as well as the children sometimes, just to remind yourself to do some of those early language skills, can also perhaps be a helpful a helpful thing to do, just to embed that learning amongst all of the staff team, not just perhaps the people that perhaps listen to this podcast or go on the training, but to make sure it's applied universally across everybody. You know, it could be a helpful starting point.
Yeah, that's a nice idea.
We're going to move on to talk a little bit about supporting families as partners now, Nikki, if that's okay. And I'd be keen to get your input on how we can better support oracy development at home, especially in communities where children may have less exposure to rich language and where parents and carers as well may struggle themselves with oracy. So in your opinion, what does meaningful support look like for families and how can we empower them to support their own children's oracy development? And I'm thinking about that in terms of before they actually reach their setting, so in those first few kind of critical years of life, but also, you know, as they are within their setting as well, so that 2, 3, 4-year-old stage.
Yeah, so I think, firstly, I think you raised an important point about the fact that parents and carers may struggle with oracy too. So we need to be sensitive to these kind of language differences within the home and avoid any sense of blaming parents for not providing the right environment for their child. So, for example, we know that the language and literacy environment that children grow up in, so, for example, how much parents read to them or the quality and quantity of language that parents use when they talk to children is linked to children's later language and literacy development. But this association might be heavily influenced by inherited factors. So, in other words, if a parent finds speaking, reading or learning difficult, their child may inherit some of those same traits, but these shared genetic traits also shape the environment. So, for example, a parent who finds reading hard may read less often at home, not out of neglect, but because of just their own experiences. So, yeah, children's oracy development is influenced by a complex mix of both what they inherit and what they experience. And so that's why we need to approach this work with empathy and avoid placing kind of blame on families. But of course, this doesn't mean that we can't model good oracy practices and engage families in children's learning. So I guess it starts really with building relationships. So recognizing kind of the strengths that families already bring. So even if they don't use the same kinds of language practices that we might see in school or nursery, it's about meeting families where they are and not necessarily expecting formal educational talk, but just valuing their everyday conversations. So for example, a parent who may struggle with reading themselves might not feel confident to sit and read a book with their child every night, but they might feel more confident kind of singing songs or nursery rhymes. And these can build children's language development in many ways. So building vocabulary, developing a sense of rhythm and sound patterns in whichever language it is, and help with memory and sequencing. And I guess we can also support families by making oracy feel approachable and doable. So sharing some of the ideas I talked about earlier, just very simple things like pausing to let their child finish sentences, asking kind of these open-ended questions, or describing what they see their child doing in play. So these are strategies that don't require any additional resources or really time. It's just a shift in how caregivers are sort of interacting day to day. But again, that can be something that's discussed in a sensitive way or modelled by earliest practitioners. And, you know, thinking about our own language when we're talking with families, so we don't necessarily want to be talking to them about developing narrative skills because that's a little bit remote, you know. So we might just talk about telling stories about their day or telling stories. So the more accessible the language is that we use when we talk about children's development, the more, I guess, families are likely to engage. And I think I've mentioned it already, but sort of modelling these language practices that we've been talking about. So the way we talk with children in front of their caregivers can be a kind of subtle but maybe powerful way of modelling some of these supportive language strategies that we've been talking about. So it's kind of less of a sort of, do as I do. It's just sort of showing how it can be done. And finally, I guess really important is listening as well. So kind of creating that space for a two-way dialogue between families and practitioners. So not just practitioners telling families what to do, but listening also to their experiences, learning from their knowledge of their child. As you say, you know, before the child reaches the earlier setting, that parent has been with that child already for 2 years or whatever. And so they know them better than anybody. And trying to work together to find out, what works for that child, what that child's interests are that you can then use in order to sort of promote oracy once they reach the setting.
So it sounds like quite a lot of the advice is really the same advice that you would give to practitioners. So it's really just about those practitioners sharing that information with parents in a kind of sensitive and effective way, really, I guess, based on the parents you have in your setting, and I guess each practitioner will know that, know what approaches may work for them.
Yeah, and also, just as I mentioned, you know, the parents will know the children as well. So, you know, it's kind of working together to with the practitioners with the knowledge about what might be supportive in terms of children's language development, but also the parent knowing what's feasible and what their child's interests are and, you know, strengths and needs. So,
it really highlights the importance of good transitions, doesn't it? So that transition from home to school and making sure that, you know, that's done in the best way that it possibly can be. And also, you know, between different classes as the child grows as well, those transition points and opportunities to talk to parents are really valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So thinking about what you've just said, Nikki, about practitioners really doing that really good transition and talking to those families about what words they use at home, their language and things like that. And do you have any other thoughts on how settings can genuinely celebrate that home language, the family talk, the storytelling traditions that those families might be using at home?
Yeah, so I think, as I just touched on, having that kind of two-way dialogue is really important, because I guess, you know, you can bring in stories and traditions from children's homes into the earlier setting. And that not only will that make children sort of feel more, give them a stronger sense of identity potentially, but also it helps children also to learn about, you know, other children's backgrounds and interests and these different kind of traditions that we might see. So I think, sort of capitalizing on this diversity in terms of language experiences, storytelling traditions, and all of those things can actually, and ways of speaking as well. We talked a little bit about kind of maybe idioms and things like that that you might want to bring in. So having that two-way dialogue with families and trying to embrace some of the home language practices and bringing that into the earlier setting so that all children can benefit and learn from it, I think is important.
We're fast approaching the end of our conversation, Nikki. So I just wanted to ask you, if you could change one thing about how oracy is approached in the early years, what would it be?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to say goes back to something I mentioned earlier. I think a lot of what goes on in early years education is already a really excellent example of oracy in practice. So, you know, many activities within early years settings are built around oral storytelling, book talk, rhymes, questions, all of those things. And as I mentioned, to some extent, oracy is already prioritised more in the early years settings than it is in schools. So I think possibly the most important thing to think about is to sort of think about oracy as a shared intentional practice across the whole setting. So not just something that happens during circle time or story time. We've touched on this already. So it's about recognising and taking advantage of opportunities throughout the day to build on children's language. And so this does require quite systematic planning and making conscious decisions about how we can model, scaffold and extend children's communication in different situations. So it's making sure that everybody has that knowledge and skills in order to be able to do that within the setting. So, for example, we could use snack time to ask open-ended questions about children's thoughts and feelings around food. So, for example, why do you like that banana? And also maybe to model descriptive words like crunchy, sweet and ripe. So it's kind of seizing all of these small opportunities throughout the day just to embed those kind of oracy skills in the activities that you're doing. But also, as I say, I think it's something that maybe needs to be a little bit systematic in order to make sure that everybody is on board and knows what's happening. And thinking, you know, quite carefully about what sort of language you want children to be using across these different activities. So being aware of these different sort of, I talked about registers of language. So languages, different types of language that you might use in different contexts. So as I say, a lot of these practices are already happening, but I think it's just about understanding why they're important and making sure that everybody's on the same page.
Lovely, thank you.
So Nikki, when practitioners walk into their setting tomorrow, what's the greatest thing they can do immediately that's going to have a really big impact?
So I think a really kind of impactful thing that practitioners could do that really doesn't require much in the way of, anything in the way of resources or time, is just to think about their communication style when they're interacting with children. So firstly, to slow down, both in terms of allowing the child time and also introducing pauses into your own speech to allow children that processing time. Secondly, to really tune in to what children are saying or trying to say. And then thirdly, respond to them in a way that builds on what they've said. So whether you're kind of expanding on a child's comment or pausing to let them finish their thought, or just kind of staying with their idea a bit longer. Just that act of being present in conversation with children could do so much to support their language. You don't need new resources, you just need attention and responsiveness. So yeah, I would say it's kind of three things, but slow down, tune in, and respond.
Thank you, Nikki.
I think that brings us nicely to the end of our conversation today. So I just wanted to say thank you so much for joining us today, Nikki. It's been really insightful learning more about what oracy is, what oracy looks like in the early years, and how we can all build and embed more oracy into our practice. So thank you again for sharing all of your knowledge and all of your experience with us too. I've certainly learned a lot. I'm sure our practitioners at home will have learned a lot too. So if you are listening and you've enjoyed this conversation, then please do share the episode with all of your colleagues, because I think it's a really, really helpful topic to look into. And yeah, I really, really appreciate you joining us today. So thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you both.
Before we let you go, we started a bit of a closing tradition on our first podcast, which we'd like to continue with, which is where we ask our guest speaker to leave behind three questions for our Norfolk Early Years practitioners. And these questions are for our listeners at home to think about between now and our follow-up face-to-face communication hub meetings, which next term will be starting from the 17th of June.
So the first question, you won't be surprised to hear, is around storytelling. So my question is, what role does storytelling, which includes books, retellings, role play, play in your setting? So I've just had a couple of sub-questions to make that a little bit more specific. So how could you strengthen the link between stories and oracy in your practice? And how does your storytelling, whether through books, retelling or play, support emotional literacy and theory of mind? And then the second one is around what I sort of finished with talking about. So in what ways do you consciously create space for children to lead talk, not just respond to adult prompts? And the follow-up bit of that is, how might you shift more interactions from adult-led questioning to genuinely shared thinking?
Brilliant. And number three?
Number three is, how can you support oracy for children who communicate differently, whether due to language delay, EAL, neurodivergence or shyness? And the sub-bit of that is, how can you ensure multiple entry points into talk? So ideas of different ways of getting into oracy, and make sure these children are equally included in peer dialogue.
Brilliant. That gives us a huge amount of food for thought. They're really excellent questions. Thank you for sharing them with us today. I think we're going to have a lot to think about following those. So brilliant. I'm really looking forward to exploring those more at the next sessions. Thank you again, Nikki, for joining us. It's been great having you on the episode today.
Thank you, Nikki.
Thank you.
We'd like to remind everyone that as part of our new Communication Hub format, this podcast will be followed up with a face-to-face workshop-style session in your local district. These workshops will provide you with an opportunity to delve deeper into the topics that we have covered today, think about the practical application of embedding oracy into your setting, and network with like-minded professionals from your local area. You will also have the opportunity to talk to your early years advisor and improvement development worker about any support you need. Plus, you will have the opportunity to ask any questions in person to our speech and language therapists. These Communication Hub workshops are open to all Norfolk early years practitioners, teachers and professionals. For early years practitioners and those working in schools, please book onto the Communication Hub workshop via the portal. And for everybody else, please email earlyyearschildcare@norfolk.gov.uk to reserve your space.